Before we get started with today's show, remember the Jalen and Jacoby After Show continues this Sunday following Lance Part 2, an ESPN 30 for 30 film on Lance Armstrong's rise and fall in the sports world. Hear from Armstrong himself in a film that insists the audience make its own interpretation on one of the biggest doping scandals in history. If you missed Part 1 of Lance, it's available to stream on ESPN+. Also, I want to remind you about another great ESPN podcast, SV Pod. Scott gets some of the best guests out there, so be sure to check it out. You can download and subscribe to SV Pod, as well as download and subscribe at the right time on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You've heard us talk about Hims and how they're helping guys look their best. If you haven't yet, it's time to see what they're all about. 66% of men lose their hair by age 35, and that is a big problem. Trust me. Why do guys sit there and do nothing about it when they can turn to medicine and science? Once you've noticed thinning hair, it can be too late. The best way to prevent more hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some. It's time to write a new chapter, one in which you have hair. The only solution is for Hims.com. It's a one-stop shop for hair loss, skin care, and other wellness supplements for men. Hims is helping guys be the best version of themselves with licensed physicians and FDA-approved products to help treat hair loss. This prescription solution's backed by science. Hims was created by a guy who knows some men's health conversations are easier online than in person. So no more awkward in-person doctor's visits or long pharmacy lines. For Hims connects you to real doctors online. It can save you hours. It's completely confidential and discreet. You answer a few quick questions, the doctor will review and determine if it's right for you and can prescribe you medication to treat hair loss that is shipped directly to your door. Right now, my listeners can get started with their first month free. Go to forhims.com/Bomani. That's forhims.com/Bomani. Prescription requires an online consultation with a physician who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Offer valid if prescribed. 3-month minimum subscription. Additional restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information. Remember, that's forhims.com/Bomani. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, Cam Newton still doesn't have a team. We will talk about this Lance Armstrong documentary and also your stories about the time you got run up on like you was Earl Thomas. But first... All right, so I was sitting at the crib on Saturday. Got a call from my man, Eric. He's my boss, even though he's not really my boss. It's a very complicated situation. But anyway, he had something to ask me about, and I answered it. And then he asked if I was watching the match, you know, the Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson situation. And I wasn't, because I had seen all the terrible weather. And so since I had seen all the terrible weather, my thought was, hey, man, it ain't going to be on. But then he said, turn it on. And so I got there. And Gabe, I can't remember this. Are you a golfer of any sort?
I'm not. I used to play more golf when I was little, hurt my shoulder, stopped playing golf, was never a golf watcher. So golf has kind of disappeared from my level of interest.
Gosh, I would like to point out that this idea of you playing golf as a kid means you were probably the kid. I hated that golf, man, because I got to golf late in life, right? I started playing golf when I was like 27, 28, and I'm out here trying to figure this. I'm out here trying to learn this, man. You'd be at the driving range, be some little six-year-old over there smoking it, right? Just hitting screamers.
Let me preface this. I wasn't actually very good. Grew up in Napa, lived down the road from the country club. Got a bunch of friends who are members of the country club. You get to go and hit balls, that sort of thing. My parents trying to put you through lessons because they think like, oh, tennis, golf. Those are sports that you can play for your whole life. So let's get Gabe trained up on both of those so that if he's not good at anything else, then he actually still has like a hobby. Yeah.
They tried to get you out here to get these activities that will put you into places to meet important folks in business. And you messed around and got me. That's the grand irony, right? But like, I enjoy playing golf. I like it. I like going out by myself more than anything else. I'm also just not very good at golf, right? Like, I'm not really good at all at golf. I haven't played now with any level of consistency since I left North Carolina. But it's just not like I enjoy it, but I'm not that good at it. And so I play by myself because I hate to be that guy that's bringing everybody down, right? I'm slowing everybody down when I'm out there because I'm just not good enough. You know, like I don't ever want to be that guy. And I've always said that I just want to be good enough at golf to play if I get invited to like some charity tournament, to like some pro-am. You know, like that's all I want to do is be good enough to go out there and do that. I don't care about being great. I don't get mad when I'm out there anymore, like all of that stuff, right? And I've always kind of wondered, because anytime I've been out there, I've never been playing golf with somebody who was like bad enough that he was holding me up. I've never been that guy. So I don't know what it looks like when there's this one guy who just holds everybody up. And thanks to the match, I know exactly what that looks like. And it looks like Tom Brady. Like Tom Brady, and I can't say that we are all Tom Brady or we've all been Tom Brady, because y'all haven't all been Tom Brady. Y'all all haven't been in that place where you feel horribly embarrassing holding everything up. And then it's worse for me because I'm black. And see, what y'all don't understand about being a black dude at the golf course is, if you are having any trouble, don't you worry. There will be somebody coming up on you very quickly to ask you if you need any help getting off the course, one way or another. And I need you to understand, it ain't just white people that's doing it. I used to go to this course in Durham, and I used to play, and it was a hard course that wasn't a fun course. Like, it was just hard. It just got on your nerves. And I used to have this dude riding around, and he had a sign in his cart. He called himself the Chief. That was, I don't know if he named himself or they named him the Chief or whatever he is, right? I feel like if I looked at his driver's license, the last name on it would be Ruckus. Like that, that's what I saw. And he used to just hassle me and my man Jeremy. Just stay hassling us. You guys all right? Maybe you guys need to play best ball. Maybe y'all need to stop scheduling so many people out here on this course. How about that? Like, I'm just saying, like, when I get out there and I'm not playing well at golf, somebody gonna come holler at me about it. There's gonna be somebody having some level of discussion with me about it. Anyway, that was all about me and nothing about Tom Brady. But I looked at Tom Brady and I was like, damn, dog, I know how you feel. I know how you feel. And in his situation, like when I'm bad at golf, they all understand I'm just trying. You know what I mean? So they nice to me about it. People out here giving Tom Brady the blues. Charles Barkley, whose golf swing looked like it's a glitch, he out here talking smack to Tom Brady. You see what Tom Brady did after Chuck talked that noise to him? These guys, different than the rest of us to a degree. They said a little something. It got him a little bit mad. He's like, watch this. And not only did he hit it in with backspin. Like, that was the thing that got me. Now, I have a friend. I don't remember if I told you this. A buddy of mine who works over on Highly Questionable and on some of Eric's shows. Old Money Charlie's granddaddy is like one of these golfers that like they make a movie about. He's like, this is the best way to put it. He's the dude that's not on the tour that all the cats from the tour all said he had game, right? Like, he is kind of like the golf equivalent of a playground legend. That's who he is. He's from up around, you know, that Northern California way. He's up there where you are. But he knows a lot of the golfers, and so he knows Tom Brady. Like, Charlie knows Tom Brady. He could get Tom Brady on a FaceTime if he made a couple of calls, like that sort of situation.
They got him on Stupidity.
Yes, that's how they had that happen. And so I asked Charlie, I was like, I need a scouting report. Like, what is Brady's game? And he says, well, you know, he's like most guys that are that athletic. He's got a really good swing. On the green, it's all about feel. And he just doesn't play enough to have that level of feel. Bro, we saw Tom Brady hit an eagle. In watching that, it had me thinking. Tom Brady gave more credence to the idea that these super great athletes can sometimes, not always, but sometimes just decide, okay, I'm going to do this thing here now. And then that thing gets done. I don't know if it's magic. I don't know if it's luck. I don't know whatever it is, but I feel like we saw that twice from Tom Brady out there playing the golf. He split his pants in front of everybody. He had to go to them other pants that was so big. Tom Brady was out there in the coveralls looking like a Ghostbuster. Except they weren't coveralls. They just looked like coveralls because his clothes didn't fit at that point. And somebody made a great point, man. Actually, it was Jay Kang, great writer, who made this point. He was like, white privilege is somehow Tom Brady coming on television and shooting a 115 and becoming more endearing to the population. And I'm not going to lie, he became a lot more endearing to me as I watched him struggle to play golf. Like, some of them strokes, them swings he was hitting, I was like, oh, that's me. Like, I know exactly how that one looks. I know how that feels. The difference between me and them is they was playing a lot of holes that had hazards like right in front of you. Man, you put that hazard directly in front of me, I might as well just throw it on the other side and call it three. Now, there's no need in wasting that ball. Brady looked like he lost like three sleeves of balls out there, but also hit that joint with the backspin in and then hit that eagle putt a little bit later. Like, now I'm at the point where I can afford to buy extra balls, right? Like, I used to be out there when I first started playing, having to make some legitimate business decisions about whether I could afford to continue playing. First time I played golf, man, I played so much golf. It was at this track. It closed down. Broke my heart. Lakeshore Golf Club in Durham over off of Miami Boulevard. And I played so much that they declined my card one time. Which, by the way, when you are the dude on the radio, they're looking at you like, wow, this must be horribly embarrassing for you. And I'm looking at them like, oh, that hasn't happened in a while. Like, I'm like, this ain't my first rodeo on the card decline, you know? And I know it could be anything. It could be my fault. It could be your fault. It could be nobody's fault, right? It could be that time the state clipped my whole bank account because they said I hadn't paid my taxes. And then I called them and they were like, oh, my bad. It was, we put it in the wrong column. You know what I'm saying? Like, it ain't, I don't have my card declined so many times in my life that I know that it might not be personal. In that case, it was, just to be clear. I went and checked it out. No, I was just broke. I had just been playing more golf than I could afford to play. That was just where I was at the time. But I figured out what, if there was a problem with the match, you know what the problem was? The golfers. They were the least fun. They contributed the least to the program. All they were out there doing was being good at golf. The most interesting thing was the guy who was not good at golf. That's it. Peyton Manning, I feel like you could, like, if you knew Peyton Manning, your only two options are to love him or to hate him. Everything is in place for most people to see Peyton Manning as a guy that they would hate, right? Like, rich kid, you know, son of this football player, all these private schools, you know, like all these things. And it was a little difficult with him when he was young because he was one of those really precocious types who was already prepared to talk to adults. And I don't think he knew that much about like talking to kids his own age. And he was very mature, but did not understand the responsibility of being mature. So the guy who would be like, actually, like, guys, okay, the protection, the offensive line wasn't very good. Like, not knowing that you can't be that guy to say those sorts of things. But he seems like a cool enough cat. Like, I was watching him out there with those dudes. Like, he seemed like a cool enough cat out there making it happen. But I want, get the golfers out of there, man. Like, I want to watch this, like, a foursome with just athletes. Because clearly we didn't care that much about the golf itself, right? Like, if we watch a bunch of dudes, four dudes out there and they all shoot in the 80s, we're not really going to know no difference, right? Like, we're not really going to care about that. If that happens, so like, who else can we get out there? Like I said on HQ yesterday that rather than Peyton Manning, I want to have Lamar Jackson. I'm like, nah, give us Peyton Manning and give us Tom Brady. But like, I want to find out who the dudes are out there that are like the Freddie Gibbs it is. Like my man Freddie Gibbs plays a lot of golf. Scarface plays a lot of golf, right? Like who are the guys that are out here, athletes that we don't know play a lot of golf? Somebody get Lamar Jackson out there learning how to play this golf. I'm about that. I'm down to see that. What if, let me tell you who I bet is awesome at golf because he is awesome at basically everything that he tries to do. And I want to get him in one of these pro-ams. Odell. Get Odell out there. I don't even know if Odell's ever played golf. I bet he's one of those dudes the first time he plays golf, he'll shoot a 90, 85 or 90. First time. And like a monster course. Cause he's going to be out there talking like he can't help it. You know what I'm saying? Like he's going to be that dude that's out there.
It was interesting too, all these kind of like parallels in the last few weeks where you have Charles Barkley kind of low key commentating on the call, right? And then Charles and Mike used to play golf all the time together. Whole deal during The Last Dance about Mike and his relationship with golf and all that sort of stuff and his wild competitiveness and like how good really was he and all of his gambling problems, you know, related to the golf course.
Well, who would we like to see Michael Jordan play on television? Because Foxworth mentioned he wanted to see Mike in one of these. Who do we want to see Mike play against, right? Because we know Oak going to be carrying his bag. So, like, who would we like to see Michael Jordan play against? And what I mean by that is, who would you like to see beat Michael Jordan at golf till it gets to the point that Mike's trying to put $500,000 out here on a hole? Like, was it in the Jordan rules or was it another interview where, or maybe in the documentary, I think Will Perdue was talking about this, how, you know, the guys in the back are gambling big money. And he didn't say it explicitly, but the white dudes up front gambling little money, right? Paxton and Will Perdue. And he said that Mike every now and then would come up there and want to play against them. And they're like, yo, why are you even up here? And he's like, because I want your money in my pocket. Oh, another story. I can't remember where it was, but they asked Mike where he wanted to set the level of the bet. And he said, whatever makes you uncomfortable. I mean, that's the only way Mike can set a line on a bet, because he got it, right? This is only fun if it makes you uncomfortable. That's the only way we got some stakes in this.
I feel like what happened with the match just opens it up for the possibility that MJ is going to get bullied into playing.
Oh, you just got tossed the to him. That's all it is. That's all it is.
So who's it going to be then?
Who can make it? Who is he not tolerating this from? You just need somebody who's really, 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 really good at golf, right? Like Steph Curry would be an interesting guy in this case, because Steph Curry, from what we've heard, is really, really good at golf, right? He could get out there and he could say something to Mike about like how his teams are better than Mike's. Ooh, except I don't even think he needs to talk to Mike, because the show is Mike, right? Like Mike's the whole show. Like Steph's just good enough to make it where it's hard on him. Then we could kind of go from there. Cause like, really, you stop and think about that, the match. You don't remember anything from the golfers. You know, like we tried to make a story out of it on Highly Questioned, but it was like the seeing Tiger, because Tiger hit every fairway. And like the seeing Tiger hit every fairway, get you excited about him this season. I'm like, man, I'm gonna pay attention to him four times this season. All right. That's it. That's it. If he ain't in it on, if he's out of it on Friday, I am too by Saturday. All right, Gabe, Cam Newton still does not have a job. I don't know fully what to make of the fact that Cam Newton doesn't have a job, because Joe Flacco got a job now. The Jets signed Joe Flacco. Joe Flacco got a job. Now, I mentioned Joe Flacco because Joe Flacco's coming off of a neck surgery, and the most plausible explanation for Cam not having a job had to do with the fact that teams couldn't check out his body. They could not do a physical, you know, in this time period. And then you see Joe Flacco show up, and he's got a job. It'll basically be like, I don't really understand what is going on here. And to be clear, he's not the only person that doesn't have a job. Jadeveon Clowney, for example, he still does not have a job, right? Like, there's a lot that's going on. Free agency can play out even under optimal circumstances in ways where guys wind up going a while without having a job. But Cam does not have a job. I don't know what the explanation is. I feel fairly confident that there's something plausible to explain it. I'm not leaning all the way towards something being sinister. I just still am blown away by how much so many of y'all hate Cam Newton. Just absolutely hate the dude. So I was on the internet on Sunday and I literally just noticed this. Cam Newton is 15 months older than Taysom Hill. That's it. 1 year and 3 months. Like, it's just kind of crazy to think about. Like, separate from how, you know, they're being treated right now, so to speak, whatever it is. Just the idea that Cam Newton has been in the league for 10 years now, and he is just a month and a half older than the Saints quarterback of the future. Like, that's a wild thought to have. I put that up, and then immediately, yeah, but he's got a lot more miles on him, too. Yeah, but da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, but da-da-da. Now, please keep in mind that Taysom Hill had four season-ending injuries when he was in college. Four of them. He was in college for 6 years or something like that. Like, he's got miles, guys, okay? Like, the dude also has miles, but that wasn't even what I was talking about, right? Like, to me, it was as much just a reminder of how young Newton is, miles or whatever, but you would not have necessarily thought that that was the case if I had not told you. But it was just a quick pop-up. Why this Cam? People on that didn't recover the fumble in the Super Bowl thing. Like, every quarterback would have jumped on that ball. Go watch NFL tapes and see how many times you see a quarterback jumping in the pile. Especially the ones who start 16 games every year, right? Part of how they start 16 games every year is they don't do stuff like that for whatever it is. But, you know, like, all this just came back around. And it is so wild to me that even now in 2020, y'all hate that dude so much, and I need somebody to explain why it is. Like, the people who actually know him, and understand, I know enough people who know him who do not like him to understand that there is room to, like, legitimately dislike the dude. He ain't for everybody. There is a great big giant outsized cartoonish ego that is associated with him that is not necessarily the easiest blend with everybody. Not everybody's going to fall in line with that, especially as a dude is not that good. If he's not that good, he wasn't that good the last time we saw him play, obviously because he was hurt. But you get my point that I'm making here. Like, if those people who know him do not like him, I get that. What gets me about the people that are just fans that be talking this is, y'all ain't really got nothing to work with on this one, right? You know what they get to? I don't know. It's just something about him.
How much of that is educated by the media and what the media says? Because I feel like the same kind of like turn happened on Odell. Odell, flashy player, you know, always has a lot to say when it comes to press conferences, very energetic personality, all that sort of stuff. Like when he's balling, everybody loves him. When he's not balling and when he's like getting all hissy fit and whatnot on the sidelines, like the media turns on him. That's like well chronicled, yeah. Right? But because the media turns on him, then it's almost like then the fans start turning on him because they think, oh yeah, yeah, see, he's washed.
Right. I think that what happens with Cam, I think that what you're talking about is it that the media turns the public on a guy like him, or the media provides the public the argumentative tools to express what they already feel, but they can't necessarily explain, right? So if you don't rock with him regardless, because like, so for example, when Cam was winning the MVP, the media was pretty much on board. You know, that was the year they giving the football to the kids in the front row, you know, and all of that stuff, you know, and everything else. The media was on board with it. They went to the Super Bowl. But those people didn't stop hating him. They just had to be quiet. It's kind of like with Barry Bonds' 73 home runs, right? You didn't hear anything about like how much people hated him while that was happening, because in that moment, they kind of had to be quiet. After the 0-2 World Series, they had to be quiet. Even though the Giants didn't win, Bonds had one of the best World Series we'd ever seen. But all it took was Game of Shadows or whatever it was. And then boom, you reminded how much them people actually dislike him. I think what happens in the cases of these two guys is once something bad happens, the media often jumps on the same way. And often their arguments don't make any sense. But the fans just need anything. If they don't like somebody, they don't need it to be right. They just need something like to get them away from, I just don't like that guy. And that's the place that he winds up in. And the only problem I have with it is, if you don't like him, you don't like him, but you don't have to lie about what he is. Like, at his best, that dude was as good as anybody playing quarterback in the NFL. At his best, there was no other quarterback in the NFL that was asked to outright carry his offenses in the way that Cam Newton was, while consistently throwing to a bunch of bums. I think it was Roger Sherman who sent me this, but the largest contract that the Panthers ever paid out to a receiver while Cam was there was 3 years, $10.5 million to Russell Shepard. They didn't get it right on any of the draft picks that they tried to get in with them. They had Mike Shula's offensive coordinator, which I did not think was a bad call as an offensive coordinator. But the thing about Shula was going to keep it simple. We were going to run the ball, and then we're going to make big plays in the passing game off the play action. Like that's just kind of what you got. It was never going to be anything inventive. At this time where the like offense was exploding intellectually, that wasn't what you were getting from Mike Shula. The Panthers were not scheming up anything to help Cam. Everything was in place. Hey, Cam, throw this guy open. Hey, Cam, go get this first down. Hey, Cam, go do this, right? I can't think of any other quarterback, Michael Vick included, that was ever, prior to Cam, because Lamar Jackson, I think, fits this description, the centerpiece of the passing game and the centerpiece of the running game. It was just a different animal out there with him. And they had it pretty, like, striking level of success with him doing that. Like, he has been very good. He's a guy that's not going to make the Hall of Fame, but everybody that was here remembers that, man. And this dude was cold. And I ain't never seen a quarterback ever that was as cold as this dude, where people are just looking to say that it's over, where people are just excited to be like, oh, well, he's washed up. People were more excited about the idea of picking up Michael Vick after he did 2 years in the Bing. Keep it in mind that Vick's last year before the Bing was his worst year as a quarterback, right? I think he ran for 1,000 yards, but if you watch them in 2006, that dude didn't look like he had it. People were more charged up about the idea of that dude than they are about Cam Newton in 2020, and I just find that to be bizarre. We normally will give a quarterback every chance we can to demonstrate that you can't do it no more. And in this one, we're like, no, you ain't got to show us, big dog. We already know. I myself don't. I'm not as sold. He might be finished. He really might. I don't know. But if you're willing to entertain the possibility that Phillip Rivers at 37 years old, coming off his worst season on a team that outside of him was actually very good, but you think he can still make it happen for the Colts, and maybe he can. How you bailing on Cam that early? Well, you know, he looked like he was finished the last time we saw him. I mean, and then he didn't play any football games. There's a chance that some of this has gotten better. I don't know the particulars on the shoulder. I don't know the particulars on the foot. But this ain't the first banged up quarterback that there's ever been. And with the rest of them, there's been a line to go pick them up. There doesn't seem to be a line at all with this dude. And if that's what it is, I guess that's what it is. But we can all acknowledge that it feels strange. All right, Gabe, have you checked out the first part of the Lance Armstrong 30 for 30?
I did. I watched it last night in preparation for this show.
Gotta say, I find it to be very interesting. I actually kind of feel like it's like a little tough play for the documentary because it's coming on the heels of The Last Dance. So, like, it's impossible to get people, like, kind of up on this. But I feel like if there was a long promotional lead-in to this one, like similar to The Last Dance, that America would be all over this because I guess everybody here or most people listening to this are old enough to appreciate what a big deal Lance Armstrong was. But part of what was interesting about this to me and watching it was realizing how long ago that this was now. Like he won his first Tour de France 21 years ago. You know, like that's a gap, right? That's some time that is going back here. And so if we go back a little further, because I didn't think the documentary did a great job of this. No American had won the Tour de France until 1986. Greg LeMond, he won it in 86. And then I want to say he won it again in either 89 or 90. When that happened, like after that comes up, when SportsCenter was like America's sports section, the Tour de France is in there all the time. Like even when the Americans weren't winning, there's a block in SportsCenter on the Tour de France. And that's a big part of that is because LeMond won it and no American had done that before. And so that starts to build. So we as a country had an awareness of the Tour de France going into that. And we had kind of heard of Lance Armstrong because after LeMond, we needed a new American to care about. And they telling us about this Lance Armstrong dude, right? And so he's coming up. And then Armstrong gets cancer. And I could be mistaken, but I do feel like most people weren't aware of Armstrong having cancer until after he'd beaten it. And now he's like ascending through the tour, you know, and getting to this place. But once he got there, that dude was a full-fledged American hero. A 100% top to bottom American hero because he was a fascinating intersection of something that few people can relate to, but something everybody can relate to. All right. So the cancer part. And just kind of, you know, being around people with cancer, that to me is kind of like, you know how when you always hear people when something comes up, they're like, well, I got members of the military in my family. Like damn near everybody does, right? Like that's something that that's diminishing as time goes on, but that's something that kind of brings everybody together. It's something that folks kind of all have in common. Knowing somebody with cancer or having somebody in your family is with cancer or having observed at some point the damage that cancer does to people and the pain that it brings to families, not just the individuals. That's something a lot of people could relate to, even if they themselves had not, you know, been cancer survivors or suffered from cancer, however you want to put it. I'm bad with the terms on this. Forgive me. But that was something that people could relate to. The other part that people could relate to is riding a bicycle. Like that is something that everybody has done is ridden a bicycle. And everybody that's tried to like ride a bike for real could appreciate is how hard it is to do something like the Tour de France. Like they said this in the documentary, Gabe. What was they said? It's like running a marathon every day for 3 weeks. Like it's really hard stuff. So the idea that this man beat cancer and then is participating in this incredibly grueling event, it is a phenomenal confluence of narratives coming together to create what is, in effect, a megastar. You know, like you could make an argument that at that time, there was no athlete in America that was more important than Lance Armstrong. Like there was no athlete that meant what Lance Armstrong does, right? So let's look at like 99, 2000 in that time. Let's look and think about like who the biggest like athletes in team sports are, like who the biggest stars are. Keep in mind, Jordan's out of the NBA, right? So let's just take him off the table now. Like who are we getting out of the NBA at that point? Shaq? Shaq the biggest star in the NBA? Shaq don't mean nothing like what Lance Armstrong means to people. There was no, I don't feel like there was an NFL player that was kind of like that dude in there. Like there was no Tom Brady really at that time in the NFL. Like a guy that, you know, even a Peyton Manning, like Peyton Manning wasn't Peyton Manning by that time. Like we didn't have anybody that really, that to me fit that. The biggest star in baseball was a guy that everybody hates, right? It was Barry Bonds when we're at that point. Lance Armstrong, aside from being the best at the world at what he did, connected to American life so perfectly at that time, right? Like it was all there. He was the most important athlete to Americans in general at that time. It was also just blatantly obvious that he was cheating. I mean, there was just no way around it. It was obvious that he was cheating. And they make this point in the first part of this. And this is what I thought the most interesting thing they said. And I think this tells a lot about like how media works and just how people work, right? The 98 Tour de France, I didn't realize was like the scandal Tour de France, right? Like they were just so ashamed because everybody was cheating. And they're like, yo, we getting this cheating up out of here. That's what we're doing, right? And the 99 one was supposed to be the beginning. And the dude made the great point in the documentary. He said, if this is the one where they're getting rid of the cheating, it wouldn't be the fastest Tour de France on record. And that's what it was. Everybody was cheating, right? And everybody knew it. And so you were expecting me to believe that everybody's cheating except the guy who won. The guy who used to have cancer, right? So he's out here beating all these mutants, basically, right? He out here racing against the X-Men. And somehow, with nothing but his fancy car and all his gadgets, he winds up on top, right? Come on, man. That never made any sense. It never at any point withstood logic that Lance Armstrong was not cheating, especially since he got caught cheating at the tour. Did you know about that game?
I didn't know that. And the way that he was able to finesse to get out of it.
But here's what he said. He said that what happened was the type of cortisone that he got caught using, he got caught, he took it as an injection. And he said that he's in there talking to the people and they're basically like, he said that if he had gotten caught taking a substance that could only be injected, he'd have been done for. But this particular substance, there were all kinds of ways that you could take it, including a cream for saddle sores. And he's like, the guy running the whole damn thing is like, boom, saddle sores. Perfect. Let's go. Everybody was invested in keeping the lie alive. Like everybody, like he's in this documentary saying it with no problem. Oh yeah, I got caught. But then I went and talked to them and they were like, hell, you didn't get caught. Right. And then, by the way, this is before the legend of Lance Armstrong has been built. Right. This is on the first victory. This is before he's even there. People didn't want to believe that the game was what it was. And Americans didn't want to believe that the game was what it was. Part of it is the cynicism of the money and everything else, you know, all the profit that everybody could stand to get on it. But the other part is people want something to believe in. And he had given people something to believe in. And they were going to do whatever it took to maintain the idea that he gave them something to believe in. They were not going to take that. No way in the world were they going to take that away until they absolutely had to. And so he's running this game and everybody's in on it. Everybody's invested in it. Everybody in one way or another is coming up. And his competitors, they not really tripping because they're all cheating too. Like the whole thing has gone so far off the rails that there is no clean person. Everybody is doing this. Like, that's why my thing with Armstrong has always been, I didn't judge him for the cheating. I didn't. I didn't judge him for the cheating just because it seemed like in a sport like that, where so much about what you did was just about like raw physical stuff. So like you can take all, like I'm sure there are guys in the NBA that are taking performance enhancing drugs. You can take all the PEDs in the world, but it ain't gonna make you hit a jump shot, right? Like there's like some fine skill that's being converted there. I don't know that much about cycling. If I'm wrong, feel free to let me know. But it seems like the thing that matters more than anything else in cycling is just your ability to physically withstand. And so if that's the where the margins are, the ability to physically withstand, then people are going to do whatever it takes to physically withstand. And then if you get up there and everybody's cheating, then that's just the game. And so I did not look at him like, oh, my gosh, how dare you lie to me and cheat. That never bothered me about Armstrong. What bothered me about Armstrong, and this is going to come up, I guess, in the second part, is that there were all these people telling the truth about you. And you did everything in your power to destroy them. That's always been my problem with him, is destroying people whom you knew were telling the truth. And he was such a sociopath, speaking generally. I mean, be careful. That was like diagnosis, I guess. But he'd get up there and he put that face on. Everybody's lying to him. He'd always do that. Everybody's lying from him. Like, and so what it really gets back to, and I think this documentary shows, if you want to see it, this guy that was the perfect vessel for so many things is like the biggest asshole on planet Earth. Like, I have not seen anything about him in the first part of that documentary that demonstrated that he is a redeemable human being. And this is a documentary that I think is actually giving him a pretty sympathetic play in the way that it's being done. Just, this was the guy to carry a message that was so important to so many people. And I don't think you could have picked anybody worse. Like, think about this. This is like the ego of professional athlete, but when it comes in handy. Magic basically said when he found out that I am the right person to carry this burden. That like it was time to tell people about this disease, to talk about it with the world and everything else. And he was like, I'm the guy to do it. I'm the guy that's built for it. Like you think about it. Magic did a press conference telling the world he had HIV in 1991 and didn't cry. And had his head like, think about like the level of composure that he had when you look back at that press conference and you consider it and the work that he wound up doing, coming back to play in the NBA, like all of these things. He was the perfect vessel for that message. He was the perfect guy to be in that situation, built, equipped to handle it and to deal with it in a way that worked well with other people and in a sincere sort of way. You know, he was that guy. Like I always think about this and look, this Magic's own fault. Like, I mean, this part I'm going to talk about here, but you'll get where I'm coming from. That dude sat in the bathroom with a phone book and a telephone with his wife in the house calling up all those women to let them know. Like you could very easily, if you're Magic Johnson, just be like, well, they'll see it on TV, right? I mean, they go find out. You don't have to be the one to tell them. They could be part of the everybody tell. Nah, man, that dude sat up there and called them all. Called them all. He did all this stuff. He was the guy to do it. And Lance Armstrong just seemed like the guy to do it. And instead, we got what's left of that dude. And I don't think that's good.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bo, this first story comes from Health.
Rebecca Faulkner, Axios. The coronavirus pandemic has led to an increase in rodent activity in several areas of the US. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC said in a statement, community-wide closures have led to a decrease in food available to rodents, especially in dense commercial areas. From Washington, D.C. to New Orleans, cities have had to step up rat control in response to the uptick. Chicago reported hundreds of thousands of the normally nocturnal animals searching farther to locate food, often in daylight hours. The CDC warned communities may see a rise in aggressive behaviour from the starving rats. But experts say the rodents are more of a threat to each other than people. Some rats have gotten so desperate they've become cannibals, preying on each other's young where food is unavailable. With lockdown restaurants closed, the CDC advises to take preventative action, like keeping garbage areas tidy so you can keep your neighbourhood safe from rats and the diseases they may bring.
Look, man, all I'm saying is this. Whenever they try out a new drug or something like that, who they try it out on? They try it out on rats, right? Like, that's the first people they test this on. So, like, is that what's going on now? Like, we gonna be like the rats at some point? Like if we all start getting some money coming in here, we gonna start eating each other? We gonna start doing with the rats? Like, that right there is a horror movie. And I just want to say something right now. I don't mean to get political on you, but I mean, I live in New York City. And I don't know if you guys have heard, they got very strict gun laws around this place. And all I'm saying is, if the rats is taking over, y'all gonna need to make it easier for me to buy a piece. Like, them rats is big and strong as hell as is, right? Like, I need to, if this is what the streets is about to be like, I need to be able to defend myself.
What's so remarkable about this story is that it's coming from the CDC.
Yes.
An official advisory from the government of the United States, the federal government, to say, hey, these rats are about to go crazy on you.
Just giving you a heads up.
This isn't like some, you know, like fringe article that I'm like finding in the, like, the depths of the internet. This is like serious business and it's happening.
Yes.
The funniest part about it too is like, oh, you know, Rebecca was saying like, okay, these restaurants have to kind of clean up what they've got going on in terms of their like waste situation. And what is this? Do you need like a bear trap now to keep these little guys out? Right. You know, like, you go out behind like some of these restaurants in New York. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I was about to say. You called them little guys, which you know what in New York would call them. Them guys ain't little at all. It's a, how long is it before they start opening doorknobs?
Yeah, this isn't Ratatouille. It's like, is that a raccoon or is that
correct,
a rat?
Correct. By the way, and for people who don't know, raccoons, not nearly as adorable as they appear in cartoon rendering.
Oh my God. All right, this next story comes from the auto industry.
This is Erin Marquis, managing editor of Jalopnik.com. So the way Hertz runs its business is that it has 567,000 vehicle leases on its book in the U.S. with about 200,000 worldwide. What they would normally do is sell off used cars when the demand drops. Well, right now demand is dropping because people can't fly, but also demand for used cars is dropping. It's kind of a no-win situation for Hertz. So they entered Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection late on Friday, trying to pay their debts. Their only plan, though, was to sell more used cars, and by April, the used car price has dropped over a third. It's a losing battle. All they're doing is dumping more used cars onto a market that has no buyers. So that means, for the very few of us who are buying cars, there's some pretty great deals out there. Saturday, there was a BMW 7 Series selling for 8 to 10 grand below what you would normally see that car selling for. Sure, it has rental car miles on it, but it's here for a good time, not for a long time. You can also get tons of 2019 Escalades and any shade of Toyota Corolla you want, so long as it's in black and white. And it's not just used car prices that will be affected. Automotive companies, especially the big three in the U.S., make 10% of their profit off of fleet sales to rental companies. That's just rental companies. Another 10% is to other governments and police and things like that, but they make up a huge amount of car companies' business, and with the way that their sales are dropping, it could be only a matter of time before new cars are seeing similar discounts as well.
Yo, she got a link? Where they at? Where they at? Like it dawned on me, you know, that whatever that rental car, that one that you hoping that when they don't have your car that they got to put you in one to make sure that you get one? Where they at?
You don't have any place to park it. What are you talking about?
I mean, I could get a place to park it.
You could get a place to park it. That is going to be the biggest hassle of your life. Let me tell you.
No, it's the parking garage. That's the parking garage. I mean, it'll cost me some money, but like, I can get a parking space. Look, man, all I hear right now is the best kind of exploitation that is possible. Okay. Like, if I meet a regular person and they outside, and they struggling, and they need some money so bad that they see me and they try to like sell me their car for a cut rate price, I'm gonna try to get that person to go to rehab. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not gonna try to capitalize on that person's misfortune. I remember once I went to a pawn shop to buy some speakers because, I mean, I grew up electronic shopping at pawn shops. And I was in there, and it was like maybe February, and I saw this woman in there with an iPad mini, and we're just like getting out of the Christmas season, and she's taking it back. And so it's obvious to me that this is like a gift that she has received, and she's taking it in, and they can't be giving her no more than like $30 for it. You know what I mean? Like, I saw that, and I just had to be honest about where I was in my life right then. I'm like, I'm not supposed to be here. You know, like these, like, this isn't what it's supposed to be. Like, there's other folks that need this discount in a way that I don't. And so I kind of stopped pawn shop because I felt like I was exploiting that woman's pain. Like, she was not going to be able to come back and get that iPad. And then I'm going to come in here and save me like $20 or something like that. I didn't feel good about that. But Hertz is out here having a crackhead sale. Oh, I'm ready. You damn right. Like bankruptcy. That's the games that rich people play. Like, what is the flyest ride they got on the yard? I got cash. I need to figure this out. Because at some point, I'm a water car. Look, also in these times, man, at some point, I might have to go to work before there's a Subway. You understand what I'm saying? So, like, if I can get 10 grand off, like she said, there was a 7 Series that was 10 grand off the list price. Okay, but that's not the new list price. That's 10 grand off the price for the mileage that it has. And you can be like, well, it's got used car miles. Okay, that's cool. I'm actually kind of willing to deal with that. That ain't no big deal. I'll pass them savings off to the next dude if it's really a problem. You know what I'm saying? Who got the link? It's time to go car shopping.
All right, Bo. So for this last story, it's kind of been like more of a social media phenomenon than an actual like news piece. But just got real. Like within the last like 24 hours, it started to become a news piece. Couldn't get a reporter on to join us. But basically, so the other day there was this lady in Central Park. She was in the area where you can like walk your dog and whatnot, right? She had her dog off the leash. And so being like a cat person and not a dog person, and also being someone who goes hiking on trails where people have their dogs and stuff like that, I am like, put the dog on the leash. I am that type of person. This lady didn't have the dog on the leash. This other guy taking a video of her telling her, you got to put the dog on a leash. It turned into this big back and forth. She's telling, she's going to call the cops on him. She pulled out the phone. She's calling the cops on him, saying like, oh, this African-American male is threatening me and my dog. Meanwhile, the dog is going absolutely berserk as she's holding on to the collar and the dog's basically choking itself out. Okay. So much so to the point where people were able to figure out where this dog was adopted from, reach out to the like rescue, little Cocker Spaniel rescue folks. She gave the dog up and now this lady is on medical leave. Bo, how familiar are you with Karen?
Oh, I watched it this morning. I saw the video this morning. Number one, the dogs would did her in, right? Like just the idea, because people love dogs so much. They're like, oh, I gotta get to the bottom of this. And so they found out that she works for like, what, Franklin Templeton, like some big financial company. She got a, you know, fairly significant job. And the thing that got me about it was she just went on tilt. Like immediately when the guy says something to her, she went on tilt. Like the idea that she's on medical leave, honestly, that part doesn't surprise me because that did not seem to be a well person. I'm not using that as a like justification for the way that she behaved. I'm just saying that did not look like a person who was well, like the way that she flipped out at that moment over that thing. But she says, I'm going to call the cops and I'm going to, yeah, tell them there's an African-American man threatening me. The only part that matters there is man. Like as a woman, if you call and say a man is threatening you, the cops is about to roll out, right? You ain't have to throw that last part in. You ain't going to make no argument to anybody that she did not know exactly what it was that she was doing. And that's why when we keep telling people like, hey, don't call the police over this nonsense, we don't need to say that anymore. There's no point in saying that anymore because the people who are calling the police under these circumstances are not doing so out of ignorance of how or what could happen. They're doing it specifically because of what could happen. And all that dude said was, could you put a dog on a leash? That's it, right? Just could you put the dog on the leash? That's the only thing. And me, man, let me tell you what I'd be so afraid of doing. Calling the cops on some bullshit. Like, I feel like if I call the cops on something that don't matter, you know what's going to happen after that. It's going to be on my fault. I can't imagine feeling so comfortable around police that you just call them on some nonsense and then after it's done, just be like, all right, well, thanks for stopping by. Or I'm going to need to talk to your supervisor. Like, I don't want to talk to the police. If I don't need a physical report, I'm not calling the police, man.
How do you feel about the Karen moniker? I'm interested to hear your thoughts on it.
Here's my only thing about the Karen situation, right? And I get where people are coming from. One, I kind of wish they'd pick a name. If you're going to do that, you need a better name than Karen. There's too many black people out here named Karen, right? Like, I know too many Karens in my own life for us to have taken Karen. Like, what are you doing to your sisters who are Karen when you do this? You are now lumping them in. Like, you need you a name that's like, whatever happened when I was a kid, it was Becky. Now, I guess that Becky has now been used in too many other senses and circumstances for it to use it in this particular case. But I just don't think that a Karen is the right name going for what you're going for. The other thing is this. And look, I'm not even getting into this. Is it a slur? So forth and so on, whatever it is, right? I'm not getting to that part. I think that's a little more complicated than people want to give it credit for being, like, on both sides. I do think that. But no matter what, once you get to the point where it's something that you just throw around, because that's just kind of what's happening. And so, especially in internet culture, where it's just used to kind of dismiss somebody and be like, oh, well, that Karen said da, da, da. If you're going to do that, for your own sake, I hope you're right. Because I do look and see people throw that around. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think the person that you're talking to fits the description that you're trying to use right now. You know, like the reason that this doesn't count, like, the reason I don't look at this as a slur in that way, I can do this very simply, is like, for example, the legendary N-word, right? The N-word is not a specification of a certain person. It's not. It's all of us, right? And then retrofitted to go the other way. The way the Karen stuff is thrown out there is intended to refer to a specific person. But the problem is it ain't going to be but a week and a half before it stops being about a particular person. And then it just become about all of them. And then what you got. Now, I ain't out here just weeping for white folks under these circumstances, right? Y'all be all right. You know what I mean? Like, this ain't the worst thing that ever happened to you. But, I mean, I think you figured this out. You ain't gonna really hear me out here doing too much calling people Karen, honestly, because I'm just too creative and I come up with my own.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
So it's been a couple of weeks since we've been able to do the social segment. So when we discussed the Earl Thomas situation on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, had a ton of people reaching out. Got to do a voicemail segment on this. I've got a crazy story. So we decided to bring it back now that we're doing the voicemail segment again. The Jordan Rules is over. First one comes from Phil in Philly.
The year had to be probably about 2008, 2009. And I'm in a deep sleep. And I get awakened by my daughter's mother. And now she didn't just push me to wake me up. She was just tapping on me. And I wake up. And it's a knife. And so I'm like, oh, what's going on? She's like, yeah, I went through your phone. And my work phone, right? I thought I was smart. I had two phones, so I would leave the other one in the car. And so, yeah, I went through your phone, and, you know, I see you still talking to what's her name. And what can I say? Right? Listen, I'm sorry. Right? That's on me. That's my bad. And so she's like, listen, you got to call her. And so I'm sitting there like, what's she going to want me to say? And so I end up calling her and said, hey, I'm sorry, I can't, you know, date you anymore, or see you anymore. I don't think my daughter was born at the time, but it was just like, yeah, I can't. And the knife is just on my leg. And so I'm just like, you know, I'm stuck. And so I'm like, all right, you know what? I'm leaving now. And so I left out. She's like, what you leaving for? And so after all that, she cuts me on my arm. Now it was an accident, right? But she playing with fire by having a knife. And so now whenever I see it, we got a great co-parenting relationship now, but now I always show her the scars. She always shake her head and get sad. Like, cause she feels some type of way about it. But I was just like, man, I was a bad cheater. That wasn't my game. And so, hey, it's what it is.
Yeah. He's a remarkably good spirits about that. He took all the steps. He did everything he could. Woke up with a knife on his neck.
one theme in these voicemails. It's a remarkable level of comfortability when it comes to knives.
Yeah, this sounds crazy to me.
Well, here's another crazy one. I thought this one would be funny, though, because it had something to do with Prince. So it's from our man Kevin in Arkansas.
This story is about the time my mom ran up on my uncle. So in the 80s, 1984, when Doves Cry comes out, they had the premiere on MTV. And from what I'm told, this was like the biggest thing, you know, ever, because there wasn't reruns back in the day. And so my mom waited all day to watch this music video. She'd done everything around the house she needed to do. Everybody in the house knew that she needed to watch this video. 10 minutes before the video comes on, she runs outside to check the mail. And when she comes to come back in, she finds out my uncle, the biggest asshole on earth, locks her out of the house. Locks her out of the house the entire video. And so when the video was over with, my uncle unlocks the door. She comes in. And the first thing she does is go to the kitchen, grab every knife that she could, and proceeded to throw them at my uncle all the way down the hallway. Them two always had a long-standing beef, and that's where it came from. It's always been a funny story to me.
Yo!
They always had a long-standing beef.
Yeah, but I'm asking. I'm just, like, in hearing this, I didn't know what else everybody else's life is like in this, because y'all are just way too cool. But, yeah, so she just threw all the knives in the house out. What?
What I thought was interesting about it, too, is it's not just the Earl Thomas situation that people are, like, running up on other people.
Yes.
You know? It's like, you did something bad to me, so I have to kind of come back at you with a vengeance for that.
Yes.
This next one is kind of from the other perspective, from the other side of things. She didn't leave her name, but I figured we should hear her out.
So I wanted to tell you this story about my boyfriend at the time. It was probably about 20 years ago, and he had a baby mama, and she was still trying to be in the picture. They had a little baby and everything, so he thought that she was an angel and she wouldn't do nothing wrong. She was just, you know, one of those type of girls. She was the perfect mommy, all that. So I was hell-bent on proving that she wasn't. So what I did was I started calling her. And I called her, and my name was Kevin. So me and her had a whole phone relationship for like a year. So I'll call up, I'll be like, yo, what up? How you doing, beautiful? Yeah, yo, what's up with you and your baby father? So you know I wanted to be me and you. Like, when can we get together? No, that's fine. I get it. But you know he got a girl already, right? So if he's going on with his life, why he can't go on with yours? So pretty much that's just how I did it. So probably about a year later, I had recorded all of my tape recorder. Had it on speaker. Played it back. I was like, I had a whole relationship with your baby mama. Just wanted to share that story.
Take it easy, all right?
Did you catch how she did the voice in there at the end?
I don't.
Take it easy.
I don't even feel comfortable commenting on this. I need to know what happened next.
Reverse catfishing situation.
Yeah.
And that's like, how she went about her vengeance.
Yeah, I need to. So, like, what do you do when your woman tells you this? Like, she's like, yo, here are all the tapes. What do you do? Like, I had a relationship with your baby mom, but I thought I was with you. What was unclear to me, though, was that she
knew the baby mama. Did he know that she knew the baby mama?
Yeah, that was a little unclear. I just feel like we need to let this sit, man. Like, I'm normally ready with the instantaneous response. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you to our sponsor, Hims. Thank you to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Rebecca Falconer of Axios. Check out her story on the aggressive rats the CDC says to watch out for. Thank you to Erin Marquise. Check out her story on Hertz's late night bankruptcy and how you can get a car for the low, low. And thank you to everybody who left a voicemail. Wow. Subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm going to assume you are a hater. Damn, dog, she was Kevin. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.